Hey, resilient recruiters, here's reason number two why you must attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. And that is the keynote presentations. You'll gain exclusive insights from other top billing recruiters and entrepreneurs who've either scaled their own desk or built multi-seven-figure businesses. I myself will, of course, be one of the speakers, but the presentations that I am the most excited about are not professional speakers and trainers, but other recruitment business owners like you who will be unpacking their most effective tactics and strategies. No theory, just practical insights from people who are in the trenches, ordinary people achieving extraordinary results. There's still time to take advantage of the early bird pricing. By the way, it's happening on September 17th and 18th. So don't miss out. Reserve your place now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Steve Beckett. Steve is the founder of Sourcebreaker, an award-winning recruitment technology company. Having spent 6 years at the S3 Group, Steve took the leap to launch Sourcebreaker in 2014, and they have absolutely taken the industry by storm, growing from 3 people at the beginning to 70 people today. In fact, Sourcebreaker has been listed by the Financial Times as one of the top 100 fastest growing companies in Europe. Steve is a past winner of the Recruiter Awards Entrepreneur of the Year, and Sourcebreaker has won multiple different awards, including Best Small Company to Work For. And it's an absolute pleasure to introduce you to Steve. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
All right. You are welcome. I'm looking forward to this. Now, this is actually our second attempt at this. We talked a couple years ago, just before the pandemic. And then the whole world turned upside down and the conversation seemed less relevant. So I'm excited to have a chance to do this again. Could you start just by telling a little bit about your background and how Sourcebreaker was born?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I spent a number of years at the S3 Group, which is quite a large international staffing agency. Left originally to set up a recruitment company and set about building some tools for recruiters whilst on my my six-month non-compete clause after leaving my prior employer, and spotted a huge gap in the market for search technology, and so pushed into that space, and Sourcebreaker was born, and we're now we're one of the leading providers of searching and matching technology around the world.
Amazing. So can you take me back to those early days and what that was like in that sort of startup environment? Because I think one of the positives that came out of the pandemic is a lot of startups. And
sure.
So I think a lot of people relate to that story. It's definitely, it's not easy. How did you guys start and then grow so quickly?
Yeah, sure. So the way that we started, so it was myself and my co-founder was an old friend of mine who was a software engineer. So he focused on the technical build. And then what we did in the meantime to fund building the platform was, one, we'd saved up money from our previous employers to invest in the business. But building a software company is quite an expensive thing to do. So what I also set about doing was building some other tools for recruiters, actually at the time using spreadsheets, really basic tools to create, but that were really high value for recruiters. So one of those products was it enabled a recruiter to map a market in under 5 minutes. So they would be able to identify who the top 100 employers were of any skill set in any location in under 5 minutes, which, as you can imagine, was quite a powerful tool. And we had a way, through our recruitment knowledge and our Excel knowledge, we're able to build really effective tools for people. So we monetized those, made a significant amount of revenue from those, which allowed us to fund building our full SaaS matching product. And so we got our initial product to market without taking any external funding, because we were able to sell other products and services based on our own expertise to raise that initial funding. So a big bit of advice I would give is do whatever you can to start getting invoices out the door one way or the other as early as you can to start generating revenue.
Absolutely. That's good advice. I think people often take weeks and months getting their website perfect and planning, how they're going to, you know, win customers and so on, instead of just actually cracking on and
100%
generating business, which, so you had this minimum viable product, which you actually started selling and so that was this market mapping tool. How did that evolve into the fully, you know, fledged software that you have today?
Yeah, so my co-founder, who's a software engineer, was focused on building the fully fledged SaaS product. And so what we did, we benefited from being able to go to market with some relatively basic but high value products. And then we could work out very quickly what was of particular interest to people, what was particularly valuable, and also what did we think would be valuable, but actually turned out to be less valuable or was just too complex for people to use to be able to get the value that they needed to get from it. So using that information, that helped us to make sure that we were building a product that was fit for market. And I think that combined with our industry knowledge really allowed us to focus on how do we provide recruiters with exceptionally high value, but really importantly when building a product, how do we make it as easy as possible to use? There's loads of products out there that get built that are fantastic concepts, but because you're trying to get a recruiter who's under, you know, a salesperson under a huge amount of pressure to hit their targets, doing anything to get them to move away from how they currently work and to work in a new way with a new piece of technology is actually probably the biggest challenge of all. And that really helped us to understand that and make sure that we were building highly effective products, but that actually were easy for recruiters to adopt and use.
Awesome. There's actually two stories that I'd love to tell today, Steve. One is the story of how recruiters can have better access to candidates and get better at sourcing, because right now many markets around the world are candidate driven. You know, recruiters have lots of orders, but, you know, are struggling to fill those jobs. So there's untapped revenue potential there within their business. But the second story is also your own experience of scaling a company, because that's also an interesting and you know, I'm sure you've learned lots of lessons along the way there, that although your technology business are, you know, transferable over to growing a recruitment business as well. So starting with that topic then, you mentioned that like getting invoices out the door early on was important. How did you guys actually, you know, there's three of you and one of you is concentrated on the technical stuff. How did you actually go to market and start winning clients?
So very much just get on the phone and call people up, sell the product, sell the services that we had to offer. Coming from a staffing background, as a business, we were very much a sales-led organization from day one. And so just make a high volume of calls, sell the product, sell the services to people and get in the door that way. I think what you mentioned previously about people spend a huge amount of time honing their website and honing their messaging and that kind of thing. We were very much like, let's get on the phone, get invoices out the door so we can raise revenue to really focus on building a website. I think when you first start a business, it's natural to think, right, I need to get my website perfect. It needs to look incredible. I need to spend ages on the content and the wording. The reality, particularly as a staffing company, not just a technology company, but actually as a staffing company, no one's looking at your website. Like there's millions of staffing agencies out there. What you need when you first start is, and you can do this for a few hundred dollars or a few hundred pounds, is get a really basic template website, get some, you know, reasonably compelling language on there, but don't spend a huge amount of time poring over every single word that you use, because the reality is the staffing world is so competitive. People aren't going to be reading your marketing website and thinking, wow, this is a completely different staffing agency. So spend as little time as possible on that, focus on getting invoices out the door. And then when you've raised some revenue through your invoices, you can then spend on getting a much more exciting, fully fledged website out. But I think people spend too much time spending their hard-earned money on websites and things like that before they're actually going out and generating revenue. So everything should be focused on get that first invoice out the door, because you need to prove that you've actually got a potential business. If you're not able to go out there and make placements, then you don't actually know if you can successfully start billing within a recruitment company. There's thousands of people that have been fantastic billers in businesses, but then when they've tried to do it themselves, haven't actually managed to get the same level of success. Focus on getting the invoice out the door and then everything else will follow.
All right. That's great advice. And, you know, It must have been challenging, though, in the early days because no one had heard of you. Right now, you know, you've got a really high, you know, very visible brand and you know, definitely in the UK and I know in other parts of the world, people have heard of Sourcebreaker. But you're calling up recruitment companies who don't know who you are or what you do. Sure. How did you get over that initial, like, well, we've never heard of you kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So being brand new to market, you can push that as a real advantage. And then being established in the market, you can push that as a real advantage. So we're now, because we've been around for 7 years or so, people take comfort from the fact that we're an established brand and they know that buying Sourcebreaker is not a risky endeavor. It's, you know that it's an established business that's got a proven track record. Obviously at the start, there's none of that. So we had no history, no track record. And like you said, it's quite difficult to then get people to buy. So we focused on the small to medium sized agency market where we're dealing with owner led businesses who are typically far more risk, far more open to taking a risk. And also if you can put a compelling case in front of them, if they have the cash in the bank, they'll make an investment. At the enterprise side, when you're dealing with much larger organizations, people like Hays, Adecco, those kind of companies, they don't want to take the risk on something brand new. So you focus on the small to medium market and then very much push that you're brand new as a huge selling point and a huge benefit. So when we would be going in and pitching to people early on, they'd be like, well, you guys are brand new. It's like, yeah, exactly. So imagine the competitive advantage you're going to get from being the first to market on this product. Here's, here's the results that you're going to get from it. None of your competition are using this product. So not only are we going to find you twice as many quality candidates, but we're going to find you twice as many quality candidates your competition aren't finding. So those candidates are going to be getting fewer calls from people. The jobs that we're identifying for you, they're going to be getting fewer calls. So your conversion rates on those candidates and on those job opportunities will be far higher because the competition isn't there. And what we would do for people, because we would enhance people's search capability, we'd say to them, look, send us the searches you're doing at the moment. So someone might look for a Java developer in an investment bank, for instance. We would say, send us the way that you're doing that search at the moment. And what we'll do is we'll put that through our technology and we'll be able to tell you how many extra candidates you're going to find. So someone would send their search over and they might find 50 candidates off their own bat. When they put it through the Sourcebreaker technology, that might go to 150 or 200 candidates. So we can say, look, we've tripled, quadrupled the volume of candidates you have available. Have a look at the quality. These guys are just as good as the candidates you're finding, but you've now got four times as many of them. But every other recruiter is searching the same way as you are. So every recruiter, by and large, is missing a significant proportion of these candidates. When you call them, they're going to be far more receptive to a call. And that's how you really get traction as a new startup business, is you guys are going to be the only people to have this product and service. And I think on the recruitment side of things, one of the big benefits as a staffing agency, when you're much newer and much smaller, typically you're going to be far more experienced as a recruiter than your competition, who might be much larger. They might have much more resources, they might be much larger, but actually as an organization at Sourcebreaker, we typically prefer to work with smaller recruitment businesses because we know that someone at director level or with 10 years experience is most likely to be working on our roles, rather than a really big established household name where you're more likely to have somebody, not always, but you're more likely to have someone working on your roles who's only got, say, 6 months, 9 months recruitment experience. And there's plenty of really good recruiters who've only been doing the job for, you know, a few months. But typically, the more experience somebody has, often the better results you're going to get from them. So as a small staffing agency, that would be a big thing that I'd be pushing on, is that you're going to have an experienced recruiter running and working your roles, as opposed to work with a large organization that's likely to have people with slightly less experience working on the roles.
Amazing. I love how you took what could be perceived as a weakness or a constraint and you turned it into a client benefit. So
absolutely.
Yeah, great, great stuff. So can you walk me through the stages of scaling your business? Because like even in the first, you guys grew so rapidly in the beginning from three people, I think you got to, you know, 50 or 60 people within 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. What were the sort of key milestones? Because this is a tricky where, like, you, I imagine at the beginning, you personally were selling the product. Mm-hmm. And so you're generating revenue, but you're also at the same time trying to hire and train people.
Yes.
You can get spread very thin. How did you I'll let you tell the story, but what were the key milestones in getting up to like 63 people in 3.5 years?
Yeah, sure. So like you say about being spread thin, I think anytime you start a business, it's difficult not to become all consumed by it because you have this huge pressure on your shoulders. You think, I've got to make this work. I've got to be successful with this. And so, yeah, to be – to say it was spread thin, it would definitely be a good description. So what would typically happen, I'd be up at 5 a.m. and I'd be onto our developers who were in a 2-hour time zone, slightly behind us on the product side with my co-founder. And we were talking with them, working through what would be going on. And then from 7 to 8, I'd be dealing with any emails that would come in. And then from 8 a.m., we'd be on the phones trying to catch recruitment business leaders, recruitment business owners on the phone before they've really started their day. So the first few hours of the day would be cold calling, trying to get into businesses. Then later in the day, we'd be going on those meetings, going and meeting with the potential founders, and then also implementing customers as well. So it was a combination of product, sales, onboarding the customer as well, and then trying to hire people, trying to raise investment as well. So it was a crazy, crazy time. How my wife stayed with me through all of that, I have absolutely no idea, because it was literally 5 a.m. till 10, 11 at night, most nights, and then weekends often as well. And one of the things that I learned quite quickly is that that's great to be able to do that. And obviously you're typically going to do things better than anybody that you bring in to do, often because you care so much about it and you've originated it. But one of the best bits of advice I got was, if you can find somebody who can do a part of your job 80% as well as you can do it, then just give it to them and move it on, because you're never going to be able to scale if you're not able to delegate and give people responsibility to take from your plate. So spent the first year or two just working crazy, crazy hours, and then started to bring people through who are able to take a lot of that pressure off. And we've always hired for a couple of things over all else, because we feel it gives us a competitive advantage. So one of those things is potential and ability, rather than years and years of experience. So we would value far more highly someone's potential rather than huge amount of experience. So we wouldn't hire somebody with 10 years experience thinking they must be good if they have 10 years experience. There is millions of people around the world with 10 years of experience of doing a job that do not do that job at all well. We feel that if you hire hungry, ambitious people with a willingness to learn, then they will be able to pick things up very, very quickly and be able to grow. There's some exceptions to that. For example, like you can't hire a high potential finance person who's not an accountant to run your finance division, for instance. But typically in most roles, particularly commercial roles, you hire people with ability and a work ethic. And one of the things that really underpins that is humility is critical for us in every hire. So whenever we're hiring for people, it's intelligence, work ethic, and humility are the most important things. And the reason why we think humility is so key is we have a obsession with always wanting to be better, always wanting to learn. And I feel that a new graduate or a new hire into Sourcebreaker can teach me things, and I'm open to hearing their feedback and learning from them. And we want that instilled across the business, where people are willing to learn from everybody. If you have that ability, that intelligence and that hunger to learn, then people will develop at an extraordinary rate. If you combine intelligence with an ego, people don't actually develop very quickly, and you find that you can stall your business very quickly, because if people are arrogant, they're not open to learning new things, they're not open to change, they're not open to being wrong, and that causes real problems. The humility thing is absolutely essential. There's a book that I would highly recommend to anybody looking to scale a business called Black Box Thinking. It's all about an attitude to failure and how important it is to give people that freedom and that comfort to understand when things are wrong. How do we learn from that? How do we make sure we improve things next time? As opposed to feeling like if you get something wrong, you need to make excuses or you need to hide it. And again, that kind of culture can only really, really work where you have a humble workforce, where people are open to being wrong.
Amazing. I agree 100%. I think the profile you've just described is a, you know, those key characteristics: intelligence, work ethic, humility. I'm of the same mindset. Like, I believe that I can, no matter how much experience someone has, I'm confident that they can learn something from me. And likewise, I also assume going into every interaction and every relationship that I can learn something from them as well. And because I've now had thousands of interactions with hundreds of different recruitment companies, including some of the fastest growing firms and some of the biggest billers in the world, and that exchange of ideas with people who are frankly much smarter than I am has meant that I now have, you know, a toolkit of strategies, you know, habits, techniques, you know, attitudes, which are the common, you know, common traits of the top producers in the world. So you have to have that mindset of wanting to learn and wanting to always get better. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement, but just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer, so in other words, she got a deposit, and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation, and if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started. Can I ask, how do you assess these things like potential, you know, work ethic and so on? Because they're, you know, they're notoriously difficult. It's, I agree 100% there on why you value those, but how do you actually know if someone genuinely has those or if they just come across well at interview?
Yeah. So there's a few indicators that we would take. So one would be a high quality degree from a high quality university is normally a good indicator. None of these things are bulletproof, but when you're looking at it from a probability standpoint, there's a high probability that somebody who has a first class degree, for example, or a 4.0 GPA, whatever it might be, is likely to be a hard worker. They could be extraordinarily intelligent and have just got through like that. But actually the volume of people that have the extraordinary intelligence without the work ethic, I find is reasonably low. So that in itself is a good indicator, but then also looking at people's work history. So when they were at college or university, did they actually work through that period as well? So did they have an additional job or did they just literally do their degree and off they go? Because again, you can have somebody who's got a good but not top class degree. If they haven't worked through university and they haven't achieved right at the top in terms of their education, then that starts to give a few question marks. Where's the hunger there to develop and improve? And a lot of it, you get a feeling from people from the conversation. So Natural have done thousands of different interviews now, and so you can start to get a feel for when you're speaking to people, do they have that work ethic? So looking at, yeah, what do they do outside of work? What are they interested in? Something for me that I find really interesting is people that do sports that are far more, your success is determined far more by your will rather than your skill. So a football or soccer player, for example, a lot of the time they'll have an innate ability that makes them good at that sport. Whereas things like being a, like cycling, for example, or marathon running, there's a huge amount of mental strength that needs to go into doing long distance cycling, long distance running, for example. And those kind of things to me are really interesting because you don't get lazy people running marathons. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't happen. So that's a good indicator as well as their hobbies and their activities outside of school. And then looking at their achievements in their prior work history as well. So what have they done in their prior work history that they're particularly proud of that points to a really strong work ethic? So I think it's a combination of their education, their work background, their interests outside of work. And you just get a feel, I think, for it once you've done a volume of interviews.
Awesome. No, that makes sense. And can I ask, like, what's your definition of work ethic, Steve? Because it's all very well for the founder to work from 5 a.m. till 11 p.m., right?
Yeah.
But most employees are not going to do that. And, you know, there's definitely a feeling, whether it's accurate or unfair, that the younger generations, they just don't want to do that. They have different values and different priorities. And, you know, they value more is flexibility and work-life balance and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So how do you define work ethic? What exactly are you looking for here?
Yeah, so it's a combination of things, really. It's work ethic to me is not necessarily volume of hours worked. Like, I think when I first started the business, it took a little while for me to get used to the idea that, you know, people weren't going to work 5 a.m. till 11 p.m. If you speak to Adam, who's our CRO and runs a business alongside me, he would say, you know, when we first started out together, I was probably quite a lot more intense than I am now. I just had incredible expectations around, you know, volume of work, hours worked, that kind of thing. Very quickly, fortunately for me and for the people that joined the business, as I worked out that, like you say, not everybody's going to work founder type hours for obvious reasons. They're not, you know, they don't have as much on the line. The rewards for them long term won't be the same. It's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. So for us, what we really like is people that will work hard during the time that they're working. So there's loads of people that are quite happy to get into an office at 7 a.m, leave at 7 p.m, but actually not really get a huge amount done. It's like it's coming in, getting a high volume of work done. And then when the need arises, we would expect people to work longer hours, whether that's earlier or later, but not like not typically. So there's no expectation of people being in the office till 7, 8 at night in any way, shape or form. But what we try and encourage is that when people are in and they're working, they work extremely hard, and they probably work harder for us than they might do in a normal job. But then we feel that it's very much a two-way street. We don't think that candidates should be subservient to their employer by any means. It's a mutual relationship. It's an equal relationship. And so we'll give people lots more holiday than most companies. So we do 30 days holiday. But then with Christmas, we give an extra couple of days. So it normally works out about 32 days as standard holiday for people. We tried unlimited holiday, and actually what we found was people took a bit less holiday because they felt uncomfortable not knowing where the boundaries were. So we said, look, let's just make it a really significant amount of holiday. We have flexi time as well, so people can take longer lunches, start later, finish earlier, however they want to do it. So we feel that it's like we expect you got to work really, really hard while you're in, but also we're going to give you plenty of time to make sure you don't burn out. You can have breaks as well. But also, by the nature of the people that we hire, hardworking people, we don't tell people you need to work later, you need to do this, you need to do that. If they take it upon themselves that there's work that needs to be done, they'll get it done. But equally, we'll say to people, like, our technology team sometimes might have to do a release later in the evening. So we just say, look, just sleep in the next day. It's an incredibly autonomous environment where, because we try and get the hiring right at the start, where it's like, we'll hire hardworking people, we'll hire humble people. They will take it upon themselves. If there's a particular piece of work that needs doing, they'll work a bit later to do it. But that's not enforced by us. That's something that they would want to do. But then they know that they can take holiday. They can have a lie-in. If they need a lie-in, they can take a lie-in. It's just an environment where people are responsible for their own time and their own day and feel comfortable doing that.
Awesome. It's interesting what you said about the unlimited holiday. I agree 100%. I think I don't like the unlimited holiday idea because I think people will not take their full holidays because they'll feel almost a peer pressure to, they don't want to be seen to be the lazy person in the team. Yeah. Right. So I think it's better the way you're doing it. Look, I'd love to hear what the factors are that contributed to you guys winning awards for the best company to work for, because right now, there's also a talent shortage within recruiting. Mm-hmm. And like lots of companies are growing and hiring again, which means that there's more competition for, you know, people entering the business. Mm-hmm. How have you guys been able to attract and retain the quality of people you've just described?
Mm-hmm. So I think the accolades that we've picked up through the years have been very, very powerful. So the Financial Times, coming on that list 2 years in a row, is one of the fastest growing companies in Europe without any institutional backing. So we've done it via angel funding, which I think is also quite uncommon. So having that accolade is really encouraging for people. But then combining that with winning Best Small Company to Work For in London and top 10 in the UK 2 years in a row, for anybody joining a business, for the kind of people we want ambitious people, they want ambitious companies. So they can see that we're an ambitious business that's grown really quickly, but they can see that we've managed to do that whilst actually looking after our team by becoming one of the top 10 companies to work for in the UK in consecutive years. And those are really difficult accolades to win. There's no hiding behind your growth numbers. You've either grown at the right rate or you haven't. And also the best company to work for awards are famously incredibly difficult to win as well. So that gives people confidence straight away when they walk in the door. But then how we retain people and how we win those awards is, like I was referencing earlier, that autonomous environment. So people feel like they have real ownership over their work. They feel like if they need to get their work done, they will work longer to do it, but that we give them the right kind of breaks and the right benefits. We have a very social organization. People like to go out and spend time together. So we do a lot of that as well. But I think the transparency as well, all the way through the business, is really, really important. So I'm always open to taking phone calls from people, asking questions from them. We've actually just done something to even enhance that further, which is a monthly Q&A with me. So people can ask questions about the business. So they've asked about, you know, what's the latest on office space? Are we going to be moving to a bigger office as people come back into the office? What's the growth plan? What are we doing about funding? And I'll always answer those questions as openly and honestly as I can. I think people really value being able to feel like they have a relationship with their leader and that they can actually speak to them and ask some questions and they're going to get an honest answer. So we try and be as transparent as we possibly can at all times. And our instinct is typically to say yes to people on things. So unless there's a good reason to say no, we will always say, you know, yes. And we're open for people trying new things a huge amount of the time as well. So the Black Box Thinking book really underpins how we think about work. And so people are not afraid to innovate. They're not afraid to try new things. And we'll encourage that. And if it doesn't work out, you know, it was worth trying. There's been plenty of things that we've tried that haven't worked. Unlimited holiday, for example, we gave that a go. It didn't actually have the desired effect. So we changed that and made it a set amount of significant holiday for people. And I think people like the fact that they don't have to be afraid to fail. If they work hard, they know it's a great place to be. We'll socialize well. And yeah, we'll make it as great a place to work as we can for people. Like, we truly obsess on making it a great place to work. We run a quarterly engagement survey. We take the feedback that people give there and constantly try and improve the business.
I love that, how you obsess about making a great place to work. So it's not by accident, it's by design. You guys are thinking about it, talking about it, and then implementing things in the business that you think will enhance the culture and the prospects for everybody in the team. So this is so important, Steve. I'd love to just dig a little bit deeper, because I can well see after you've won these awards and accolades, it becomes a virtuous cycle, right? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, and then makes it easier and easier for people to join. And you know, but before winning those awards, like earlier on in your growth trajectory, where, you know, maybe it is perceived to be a bit more risky. You haven't won those awards yet. Like, what were you doing earlier on to attract really top people? Because you're describing people who got firsts from, you know, top universities. Those individuals have lots of different opportunities and choices available, right? So how do you persuade them to join Sourcebreaker?
So I think explaining to people about the size of the opportunity, where the business is going, the ambition of the company was really important, so people could see that there was a vision there, that there was an opportunity to really grow. And I think by focusing on potential rather than huge amounts of experience, that allowed us to attract intelligent, hardworking, humble people that had a limited amount of experience and could grow into their roles. So the opportunities that we were providing to people early on were, yes, we were a less established company, but actually for their career, they could grow at a far faster rate with us than they might be able to in a traditional company. And so the way that we did it was we paired our early hires with mentors. So for example, Gareth, who's a product director at the business at the moment, he had no product experience before joining Sourcebreaker. He had some recruitment experience, but we could tell that he was really intelligent, really humble, and really hardworking. So we felt that he could grow very quickly with the business and pick up product very, very fast, but not leaving him to, you know, flounder without any support. So what we would do is we would match Gareth with a mentor, so somebody who has a huge amount of product experience, so they could give Gareth the advice and the development that I couldn't. I've never been a product person. I'm a salesperson in terms of my background, so I wouldn't have been able to develop Gareth into a product director. So pairing with a mentor, and then Gareth could learn, bounce ideas off that mentor, and then grow very quickly into the product role. So Gareth now, from joining as the you know, the sole product person, now runs a multifunctional team that covers product design, data. There's a couple of other elements to what we do as well. So he's got three or four different departments that all report into him. He's moved from a junior role into a product role in the space of, you know, 4 or 5 years. And he's been running our product division for a couple of years. So within 3 years, he went from no product experience to running multifunctional teams. And that for me is how you're able to attract high quality people, is giving them those opportunities. Now, had we wanted to hire an experienced product director from day one, the cost of the business would have been enormous, because obviously if you're hiring someone with a huge amount of experience, there's a much higher cost to it. But also the people you're going to be able to attract is going to be smaller. You'd have to give away a huge amount of equity plus a big salary to get somebody to take a risk on a startup that you know, that has no track record. So that's where we really got success from, hiring people who didn't have a huge amount of prior experience in the role, but had enormous potential. And we now benefit from a leadership team that's, they've all typically been here between at least 3 to 5 years. So they've now got a good, strong amount of experience in their roles, but actually are still relatively early in their careers, because they took the opportunities that were given to them and have, you know, and have absolutely run with it. So yeah, hiring ability. Definitely.
Yeah, no, it's the exact same philosophy as when you were selling the business to your early customers. It's taking something that's a perceived weakness or limitation and actually turning it into a benefit. So the fact that you are a startup and you're growing fast, you've got this exciting vision, and you know, you're a hugely ambitious company, means that the opportunities for people to develop their careers quickly is much greater with you than it might be with a more established company. So yeah, it's brilliant. Speaking of development, and you mentioned mentoring, what else are you doing to develop people within the business and that talent development piece?
Yeah, so the mentoring is critical for our senior leaders. They can benefit from a huge amount of experience of people who've been there and done it before. And then our leaders will then go and execute once they've worked alongside the mentor on the strategic side of things. And then throughout the business, we have what we call, well, what anybody would call, I suppose, book clubs. So that's typically done on a quarterly basis, where within your team, people will read books, blogs, watch videos related specifically to their department, and then share what they've learned from you know, from those books, from those blogs, amongst their peers. And that is a really good way to foster new ideas and for people to develop. We have an unlimited budget for Audible, Amazon, you know, business related books or books related to specific departments, so people can develop themselves. We put a very high value on people self-developing. I've been to loads of different training courses, loads of different classes where the content's good, but it's often out of date by the time it's delivered. Reading books and blogs, there's a lot of current information that you can pick up that's specifically related to your area of expertise. And again, the type of people that we hire, they're obsessed with their own self-development anyway. And so a huge amount of the development side of things is actually, the onus is on the person at Sourcebreaker to take that upon themselves and share it with their peers. So you'll have people within the business. I can think of one of the guys, James, in the sales team. He's relatively inexperienced in comparison to the rest of the team, but is always coming up with new ideas, reading new things and sharing those with the team that the rest of the team then benefit. And I think that's really important, that that's what underpins the business, is you could have somebody with relatively little experience picking up new techniques, new things, and sharing that with the rest of the business that they can then benefit from. We also have training courses for our senior leadership team and a training program within each department so they can learn Sourcebreaker inside out. But I think self-development is critical. When people are developing themselves, they're far more engaged with it as well, rather than saying, right, you have to go and sit on this training session, where we're fortunate to have really good people where they're engaged with that kind of thing, but they will be even more engaged when they're finding things out for themselves off their own bat and then sharing that with their team. And there's that sense of pride, I think, when you find out something and you share it with other people and they're really engaged with it and they buzz from it as well. So that self-development thing is critical. So I'd highly recommend book clubs within departments for people to knowledge share on current information.
That is genius, Steve, because like it's so inexpensive and any company could do it. There's no excuse. Like, no matter what your training budget is, that is absolutely doable. And it's funny enough, we within my Inner Circle coaching program, we have a book club as well, which, you know, we now, how does yours work? Does everyone read the same book or and then discuss it, or everyone reads a different book and then presents what they've learned?
So it's a bit of a mix, depending on the team, to be honest with you. We've done it previously where everybody reads the same book, and we've also done it where people will read different things. And so some people will read, because blogs, whilst they're shorter form, actually you can get enormous value from a blog because they tend to be right hot off the press. So you could be reading the current trends in software engineering, or you could be reading what's the latest in customer success, how to manage an account effectively. So it really will vary depending on, you know, the team and what they're focusing on at that particular point. Somebody might read a book and say, guys, like, you need to be reading this. It's incredible. But someone else might read another book and say, I read this book. Here are the 10 key things that I took away from it. And then people would then take it upon themselves to go and read that in full themselves. So very much a combination. I think, again, it's important to let it be led by the teams and how they see best. We try and be as non-prescriptive, not sure what the word is, but we try not to prescribe as much as possible, because the more you empower your team to make their own decisions on their learning, again, the more engaged they are with it. If you say, right, everybody has to read this book now, that's great and there's benefit there. But again, anytime you're prescribing, there's less engagement than if people are taking it upon themselves.
Awesome. That's a genius idea. That's like my gold nugget for this call, Steve. Listen, I'd love to get your opinion on this, because in developing people and helping them to achieve their full potential and perform at their peak, the environment and picking up knowledge by osmosis and being part of having that buzz. When I was coming up, that was really important. However, due to the pandemic and the fact that a lot of people now are working remotely, either full time or part of the time, it's much harder to create that, the atmosphere and the buzz of working, you know, alongside other people, and the energy and the sort of productivity that comes from that, but also just the learning opportunities of sharing ideas over a coffee in the lunchroom, or, you know, just hearing the way that someone else is selling and then going, oh, I like that, I'm going to try that on my next call. Or a manager being able to pick up, like, hear something and coach them right then and there and say, how about on the next call, try asking the question this way. And, you know, and then doing it remotely. And so I have actually interviewed James Caan on this show. And he was very, like, people have to be in the office, like, especially younger, you know, and by young, I mean junior in their career, people who are learning the business, they have to be in the office. And he was, like, you know, very definite about that. But I've interviewed other successful leaders, and they are going completely remote, and it's still working for them.
Yeah.
What's your stance on this, and how have you guys made it work?
Sure. So my personal preference for commercial teams, particularly where they're heavily phone-based roles, my preference is definitely more time in the office than not. We don't enforce anybody to be in every single day. In our sales teams, particularly for the SDR teams and the more junior AEs, we would say to be in the office 4 days a week, but exactly for that reason. Whereas our technology functions, they are able to be far more remote, because in the technology function, you're not learning from sitting next to people anywhere near as much. Yes, there's definitely, you know, some learning that you can do by sitting next to your colleague, but for everything you've just said there on the sales side, you overhear people's calls. Oh, that was a great, you know, you delivered that really well. That was great. And then in reverse, being able to say to somebody, oh, I tried this, why don't you try that on your next call, and share that knowledge and that expertise. But also, I think from a sales side of things, particularly when cold calling, that can be, you know, it's a tough, repetitive task. And I think for me personally, when I was selling, I definitely benefited from the energy of being around other people as well. So having that shared goal, everybody's doing the same thing together, I think is, there's definite benefit to being in the office. So for our commercial teams, they're more in the office, and then the technology teams less so, because I think they don't need to be. But yeah, for me personally, I'm in 5 days a week, because I like that. I'm a sociable person. I like to be around people, but I definitely get that, you know, for a day a week, potentially being at home can be better to just get through a volume of work without distractions. So yeah, we definitely lean more in the office more than not for commercial people, but not necessarily 5 days a week.
Awesome. Okay. No, that makes sense. So you've got a clear policy, and you've got good reasons why that's the way that you do it at Source breaker. So I respect that. What's next for Sourcebreaker? Like, what do you guys, what's the vision currently? Because you've already, you know, broken all these records in terms of growth. What happens next?
Yeah, sure. So our vision is to be the global leader in AI-driven talent matching. So I think we're quite well established now in the UK as the leader. We're winning or have won most of the larger enterprise organizations now in the UK. We're increasing presence in the US as well, winning a number of the larger organizations into the US. So for us, the target is to continue to expand our presence in the US, then move more into Europe and the Asia Pacific market as well. We feel that there's a very large market to be taken for the matching world. And for us, it's to be the global leader in AI-driven talent matching. I think we're well on the way with that in Europe, and it's pushing more and more into the US, which we've got a good presence in now, taking that even further.
Awesome. No, that makes a lot of sense. We are almost out of time, Steve, but could you just, since you specialize in AI-driven sourcing technology, what tips can you give to, because this is a hot topic right now, people are desperate for candidates,
sure,
and want to find candidates that their competitors or indeed their clients' own TA teams haven't already got access to. What would be some quick tips that you can leave people with to help them get better at uncovering more, larger talent pools?
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the things that we naturally look to do is when we're in a rush to find candidates or find anything, we'll take shortcuts in order to get there. And there's a really good phrase that I'm going to get completely wrong. But it's like, if you're cutting down a tree, you want to spend 90% of the time sharpening the axe and then cut the tree. That's not right. The exact phrase, but the message is there. And so spending a bit more time thinking about your search and making sure you're covering all bases, because you might expect that if you're looking for a Java developer from an investment bank, you can type in a handful of words like Java and developer, banking, financial services, and run your search, and then you'll find all the candidates. The reality is, a really good example on LinkedIn, there's over 500,000 candidates that work at the likes of Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Citi, Credit Suisse, all of these top tier banks. They don't mention the word bank, banking, or financial services anywhere on their profiles, because as far as they're concerned, they might be a Java developer at Goldman Sachs. There's no reason for them to mention the word bank. They're a developer, they work at Goldman Sachs. And so an enormous number of candidates are missed by people looking in particular sectors because they type the name of the sector. The same is true of retail, fintech, whatever it might be. So take some time to think about what are the companies in this space that I'd like to find candidates from. And just making that simple change will add a significant number of candidates to your pool. But also, again, importantly, most people don't search like that. So you find candidates that fewer people are finding. So they're more likely to respond to your engagement. And another thing to think about is acronyms. So as recruiters, we would typically always write an acronym. We wouldn't type out the full phrase. So for example, in Cisco, an IT networking product. Qualifications there, you'd type CCMP, CCIE, but actually candidates don't necessarily think of it in the acronym. They will type out the full expression of their qualification. Another example is JEE, which is another technology term, which is Java Enterprise Edition. About 80% of candidates type Java Enterprise Edition, but as recruiters, I've never seen a recruiter, I say never, 1 in 100 recruiters maybe would type in Java Enterprise Edition. The majority would type in JEE. So when thinking about acronyms, type out the full expression as well as the acronym, and again, you'll find a lot more candidates. There's countless more different tips and tricks available to you like that, but that's a couple of really quick and easy ones that you can get massive value from.
Awesome. Listen, Steve, if people want to learn more about Sourcebreaker and how it could potentially help them to uncover more candidates and fill more jobs faster, what's the best way for them to do that?
So I would say jump on the website, have a look at what we do. We work with everybody from the largest multinational agencies, people like Allegis, people like Hays, all the way to one-person businesses and everything in between there. So if you're a staffing agency, recruitment business, jump on the website, have a look at what we do, and then you'll be able to send a message to us on the website. One of our sales guys will get back to you very, very quickly to walk you through exactly how we can help. But yeah, anybody looking for more candidates or more opportunities, we should be able to help.
Fantastic. Steve, really enjoyed this. Some
likewise,
fantastic
thanks, Mark.
Ideas that I think are quite inspiring for, you know, recruitment entrepreneurs and people who are looking to grow their business. So thanks so much.
Fabulous. Cheers, Mark. Appreciate having me
on. Thank you.
Cheers.